Welcome to the Federation Coronavirus Update Call. My name is Hilda, and I will be your operator for today. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. During the question-and-answer session, if you have a question, please press star and then one on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Ms. Sarah Armstrong. Ms. Armstrong, you may begin.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you all for joining us today on our conference call about the coronavirus. Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that these calls are closed to the press. Members of the media should hang up now and call our press shop at 202-463-5682. And as a reminder, this call is being recorded. We want to make this available to those who are not able to join the call today. Today, we're joined by Executive Vice President and Chief Policy Officer Neil Bradley, as well as our Chief Communications Officer Michelle Russo. They're going to give some updates not only on policy, but also on messaging. So they'll be joining us here in just a moment. But first, I want to provide a brief update about what the U.S. Chamber has been doing to help support our Federation of State and Local Chambers and National Trade Associations that are members of ours. I know that this has been a really tough time, a tough week for all of you. We're here to help during this difficult time, and we appreciate everything you're doing to address and respond to all the difficult challenges in your home states and your community. So thanks for your support at the local level on everyone's behalf. As you know, we're going to be hosting conference calls weekly going forward. We'll do these on Friday so that we can touch base about the week that has passed and keep you all informed as to what lies ahead. So be on the lookout for future calls on Fridays for our entire Federation of members. Additionally, we're going to be in contact with administration officials. We'll see if we can provide more speakers to you all from the administration. Those of you who joined us earlier this week for the Small Business Administration call, I think found that very useful information about the SBA loan process. I know that they're going to continue to share information with us that we can pass along to you. We did record that call, so in an earlier email, I forwarded that information to you all. There should be a recording that you can listen to and details about the SBA's disaster loan program. Other information that we've been trying to share with you as soon as it's available, legislation analysis, summaries of the response packages. We've been providing official guidelines on what we're recommending to the administration, and Neil will talk about some of those in just a minute. Just today or earlier, about an hour ago, we sent information about our letter to the National Governors Association urging for common standards for stay-in-place orders. We also sent some information about new guidance on travel. So we'll cover more of this in depth, but I just wanted to let you know we're going to continue to be a resource for you all in this challenging time. Please feel free to reach out to us if you have questions. We'll be in this together and thinking of all of you in your communities and where you're living and working with family, friends, and colleagues in the next couple of days and weeks. So I'm going to turn these things over to Neil Bradley, who will give a little bit more of a legislative update. Neil?
Thanks, Sarah, and thanks, everyone, for joining us. Let me start with kind of where we are in the Phase 3 bill. As you all know, the Phase 2 bill, this was the bill that included the paid sick leave and limited paid family leave for businesses with 500 and fewer employees, became law earlier this week, and we're currently working with the administration on implementation issues around that. But legislatively, we've turned our attention to Phase 3. This is the bill that's really focused on how we provide support for America's employers and the business community. Senator McConnell released a draft of that bill last night. Importantly, this was the Republican Senate proffer. It did not have input or inclusion from Democrats. Beginning earlier today, Leader McConnell sat down with Leader Schumer. Republican chairs are meeting with Republican ranking members with a goal of trying to come to an agreement over the course of this weekend that can be voted on and approved in the U.S. Senate on Monday. We are urging all due haste and speed because time is of the essence, but we also think it's important for this bill to get right. Let me talk to you about a couple key provisions that are in this legislation. The first is a proposal by Senator Rubio to provide loans/grants for businesses with 500 or fewer employees. This proposal would leverage the SBA 7A loan program, which many of you are familiar with, that many of your local lenders use to help support local small businesses, to provide loans up to $10 million for small businesses. Importantly, the provision says that if these small businesses maintain their payroll and don't reduce the compensation for their employees, they can have, over the next 3 months, the loan will be forgiven. If you reduce headcount or reduce pay, the amount of the loan forgiven is reduced. The portion of the loan that can be given is your payroll up to $50,000 per employee. So think of it this way, you know, if you have 100 employees at $50,000 and you keep those on the payroll for the next 3 months, you can have the cost of that payroll expense forgiven 100%, and so that becomes a grant to you. The second major element of this proposal is federal loan facilities, loans and loan guarantees. In the face value amount of $50 billion for the airline industry, the domestic passenger travel airline industry, another $8 billion in aviation cargo, and $150 billion for everybody else. The Chamber, we're supportive of all of those provisions. We're also supportive of some of the tax changes that would improve liquidity immediately for businesses. But about an hour ago, we sent up a proposal to lawmakers that suggested that we believe that we need to do more than what is currently in the Senate proposal. We have a couple concerns. The first concern is that it really leaves medium-sized employers, those with more than 500 employees, kind of in a lurch and with no clear access to quick financing that can help them maintain their operations and pay their employees. The second is even for larger employers, the ones who might be most able to access these $150 billion in loan financing, quite frankly, the $150 billion in face value loans may not be enough. And we are very much concerned about a process in which, you know, an employer who gets in first may be able to stay alive and support their employees. But if you come along fifth, once that $150 has been used up, you're simply out of luck. And we shouldn't put businesses in that fight amongst each other for those scarce resources, particularly when they're in the form of loans. Importantly, 68 million Americans work for these employers who are above 500 employees. So to help them, we submitted a proposal that would keep everything that is in the current Senate bill and would add to it a new loan program guaranteed by the federal government but administered through the financial system, our current banking system, with the support of Treasury and the Federal Reserve. The loans would be guaranteed by the federal government. They would be capped at a maximum of 3 months of payroll and related expenses. These loans would only be available for employers with more than 500 employees and businesses of those businesses who've experienced a loss of 10% or more in revenue as a result of the coronavirus. The loans could be repaid over 5 years and as an incentive for the most severely impacted employers, those who've had a revenue loss of 25% or greater, if they maintain 90% of their workforce, they keep paying their employees with this loan over the next 3 months, then 10% of the loan would be forgiven. So this is what we call the carrot approach. We're going to make sure that every business above 500 employees who is being negatively impacted in terms of revenue has access to financing to meet payroll for the next 3 months. And if they use that funding to keep their employees paid, we'll give them a benefit on the backside of forgiving a portion of that loan. Based on our conversations kind of across industries, we think kind of the combination of all these things gives us the best chance of avoiding massive layoffs and then ultimately lots of bankruptcies. Sarah and team will be circulating both the letter that Tom sent to the Hill along with a Federation sign-on letter for folks who want to support kind of this package and this proposal. I will tell you the thing that worries me the most in this phase three is that in particular that mid-market segment, employers who have 600 employees or 700 employees are going to be left out unless we provide some type of mechanism that encompasses them. And that's why your all support and kind of lending support from state and local chambers to this effort would be immensely important. Let me turn next to an item that we've been working with many of you on, including, for example, Gene Barr in Pennsylvania, who's really been on the front lines of this. And this is the definition of essential businesses when either the governor or local authorities issue a shelter-in-place or shelter-in-home order. One of the things that we started seeing earlier in the week was wide variety in terms of definitions of what was essential from one place to another, with some states adopting very, very restrictive orders that would impede essential services. We worked really closely with the administration to develop, with DHS to develop a model guide of essential services. It is not perfect. It leaves out things that we wish were included, that we recommended to be included, but it is the most permissive, a widely adopted guide that we have at the moment. And so we're doing two things. We're encouraging governors, and we're providing all copies of this to all of you to also help encourage your governors to not do anything more restrictive than what the Department of Homeland Security has recommended. Second, we're collecting all the stories about things that are left out, and we're inputting that in the Department of Homeland Security in the hopes of continuing to revise this so that we can get the best possible outcome for protecting essential businesses. Related to that is the northern and southern border. You may have seen that Canada and the United States have come to an agreement on restrictions on the northern border. This is being followed by restrictions on the southern border. Importantly, it appears that at least with respect to the northern border, the restrictions really apply to tourism, shopping, kind of travel that is non-essential, that business travel and the movement of goods and services across the border will not be impacted. If we haven't already, we're circulating to you copies of that order. It's not very long, and you can kind of get a sense that this impacts you or your members of what's in that. Let me turn to something slightly different now that we've gotten questions on from a number of you, and that is the U.S. Chamber's position on Buy America. This has been the subject of some, frankly, misleading and erroneous press reports. This has to do with the current supply chains, particularly for medical goods. What and proposals in the White House, frankly, championed by Peter Navarro, to immediately impose Buy America requirements. The chamber's position is that this episode, this event, has exposed some issues in our supply chain that we ought to address and figure out the right way to address them. But changing the rules in the middle of the road, or in the process of trying to get critical supplies that we need in the United States into the United States, is only going to make matters worse. And so we're actually supportive of a proposal that's in the Senate bill to immediately do a study of what we need to do to impact, to fix or address supply chain issues once we get through this current crisis. But keep everyone focused on the current crisis of getting the support that we need, and then we can turn to addressing or implementing any changes after we get through this. One last issue in some webinars that I've been doing with some of you, and by the way, we're happy to participate in webinars or conference calls, anything we can do to help get the message out. But, and one of them I did with the Kentucky Chamber today, the issue came up about independent contractors and gig workers and what can be done for them. Notably, you know, if you're an independent contractor, the typical unemployment insurance and those benefits aren't available to you. An exception to that is what's called disaster unemployment insurance. This is what is usually deployed after, you know, a tornado or a hurricane. That is available to independent contractors. So our team is working with the Federal Department of Labor, making sure that we get all the information out, because obviously this is a both a federal program, but we also have some local requirements in terms of designations, and figuring out the steps that the state governments need to take so that your independent contractors can access this federal benefit. And so if that's something of interest to you, just be on the lookout. We'll be getting you more information on how we make that happen. And so I've talked way too long, but hopefully that was at least some useful information. Please be on the lookout for this, the additional resources that we're sending you, in particular the letter to help us get the right outcome in this phase three bill. And with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Sarah.
Great. Thank you so much, Neil. I really appreciate that overview. I think there are probably going to be several questions related to some of the policy issues. Why don't we go ahead and open it up to questions? Operator, can you assist us with that?
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star and then one on your touchtone phone. If you wish to be removed from the question queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. If you are using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, please press star and then one on your touchtone phone. Standing by for questions.
Michelle, while we're waiting for questions to come in, do you want to give us a little update on some of the messaging that we're doing?
Sure. First of all, I want to, we, as all of you I'm sure are doing, we're updating our messaging on an hourly, daily basis. But a few things remain firm and true, which is our absolute focus on ensuring or trying, working as hard as we can to ensure that no family or no business goes bankrupt at this time. And so I wanted to just take a minute, thank you, Sarah, to thank everyone on this call for all you're doing to help us share the latest guidance, resources, and information with your members. You're truly the most powerful channel we have at the U.S. Chamber, and we sincerely thank you. I know Sarah has been keeping you abreast on a daily, hourly basis or whatever required of the latest tools and graphics and resources we've been creating, but I wanted to remind you of a few and talk about a couple new ones. There's the coronavirus digital toolkit at uschamber.com, COVID toolkit, all one word. We're already seeing 7,000 graphic downloads from that toolkit in the past 2 weeks. So thank you. I hope it's useful. We also have the How to Support Local Businesses Guide, the coronavirus customizable business flyer, which last weekend was intended to have shop owners put in their windows to say how they're protecting their customers and employees. And then we quickly turned that into something that they could post on their websites. for takeout and other types of services. And then the other day we launched a coronavirus live blog to provide the latest updates and analysis of issues of the coronavirus of most important to the business community. And that's uschamber.com/live blog. The other thing we're trying to do more of is celebrating and supporting all the businesses that remain on the front lines of this crisis and how they are stepping up. And so if you all are also trying to share those stories, we would love to have an aggregated view of that and would ask you to use the following two hashtags, which is #AmericanBusiness and #BizForGood, B-I-Z, the number 4, good. We can also send that information to Sarah to send around to all of you. So just wanted to give you a sense of what we're doing, and please let Sarah know if we can be giving you anything else that would be of value.
Thank you so much. Go ahead, operator.
Oh, thank you. We have a question from Heather Bruschetti from the Business Council of New York State.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Heather, yes.
Okay. So my question is, are there any limitations on the businesses that would be applicable or would be eligible for the proposed 7A program for businesses fewer than 500? In other words, do they have to demonstrate that they had suffered economic harm due to the virus, or is it just pretty much wide open with the real limitation just being up to 50,000 per employee?
It's pretty wide open. It is a self-attestation where if you say you've been harmed, you're kind of deemed harmed. By the way, I should note that the loan also applies to nonprofits other than those who are in receipt of Medicaid funding. And so, you know, presumably this may also end up being a resource potentially for chambers of commerce in this regard. The just looking at right here, the real limitations are just on getting the loan converted into a grant. And so the requirements there.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Kelly Hall from the Longview Chamber. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Neil, for your comments. One of the questions had to do with for employers with 50 or fewer employees, or there seems to still be some confusion about how the process is going to work. These are employers that aren't used to FMLA guidelines, et cetera. And then today, the president, when he did his press conference, he said that loans would not have to be repaid by the small businesses or 50 or under. So do you have any clarification on those items?
So let me take them in reverse. On the loans for 50 and under, no, I don't. That is not, with the exception of the extent that you use the loan for payroll, that is not what's included in the pending Senate proposal. The administration may be wanting that changed, but that's not what's been enacted or what's currently pending. With respect to the FMLA 50-person exemption, so the legislation, now law, commits to the Department of Labor this idea of kind of the hardship exemption. And so our team is already kind of in contact with those folks to figure out how that's going to work. Our position is that this should not be you have to apply and you have to individually as a business get a waiver, but instead there should be some kind of plain language application, safe harbor, that you could avail yourself of. But that has not, unless it's been published in the last hour and a half, that has not yet been published. But as soon as that happens, we'll make sure to share that.
Thank you.
We have a question from Kelly Bro from the Denver Metro Chamber of Commerce.
Thanks.
Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Neil. Hi. Thanks for doing this. You talked a little about the northern border. Our ag community is really nervous about our southern border because we rely so heavily upon workers. Do you have any insight on the chance we may have to lighten restrictions on bringing workers across the border to support industries like agriculture?
I do. I actually just pulled up the Federal Register notice with respect to the southern border. It reads, if not identical, very close to identical to the northern border. Let me give you, because a couple of folks had also emailed me this question while we were sitting here, what it says. It restricts travel to essential travel, but says essential travel includes but is not limited to, obviously, U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents, people traveling for medical purposes, individuals traveling to attend educational institutions, which I know can be pretty important, particularly on the southern border. Importantly, in answer to your question, individuals traveling to work in the United States, e.g., individuals working in the farming or agricultural industry who must travel between the U.S. and Mexico, individuals traveling for emergency response and public health purposes, individuals engaged in lawful cross-border trade, so individuals who are moving cargo back and forth, this does not apply to, nor does it apply to members in the military, who it does apply to. It specifically applies to individuals traveling for tourism purposes, e.g. sightseeing, recreation, gambling, or attending cultural events. The notification does not apply to air, freight, rail, or sea travel. So it's pretty broad in terms of protecting commerce.
Yeah, thank you. One thing we have heard is it was limited to those who had been here previously to work. If you could just help us monitor that, because I do think for our industry, that limitation would be debilitating still.
Yes, I have it in front of me, and that at least is not in this order. I can't tell you that they won't change it,
thanks.
But
sure.
It's not in it right now.
Thanks, Neil.
The next question comes from Barbara Stapleton from the Greater Topeka Partnership.
Thank you. I had a question actually related to the cybersecurity and infrastructure guidelines that were shared yesterday. Is there any means that we know of as it relates to NAICS codes or other things in terms of there being direct communications to businesses? We don't want to duplicate, but we want to make sure we're getting the information out correctly. And are there any other resources beyond that website that was shared?
I'm only aware of information that is on that website. We'll double check if that's changed, but I'm only aware of items on the CISA that are contained in that website. I don't believe it's gone down to NAICS code yet.
Okay. So there have not been communications, and we'll share those communications directly to our local businesses.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing to remember here is at least in most states that what we've seen is that this is, you know, kind of a state order. So what we'll be controlling is what the states say, and you know, I know some states are implementing this as, you know, kind of initially as voluntary restrictions, but you'll want to check what your state's doing. You'll also want to be mindful of things that could be important in your state that aren't covered. For example, in the San Francisco order, it exempted and deemed as essential construction of housing. Everyone knows the affordable housing problems that they have out there. One of the things that we suggested to the administration was also to cover construction. That is not currently in this guidance. I know we're working with Gene Barr and others in Pennsylvania to try to make sure Pennsylvania covers construction. So, you know, you just want to be mindful that this, while this is better than what a lot of states were doing, it is by no means perfect, and you may have individual situations that you want to make sure that your governor or mayor addresses.
Thank you. That's helpful clarification.
The next question comes from Glenn Hammer from the Arizona Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you. I want to thank Sarah, Michelle, and you, Neil, for your extraordinary work during this historically difficult time. Kelly asked the question I wanted on the U.S.-Mexico border. I just wanted to say, count the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry in any letter that you're going to send. It's absolutely critical that we have hundreds, if not more, chambers across the country sign on to what you're doing. And just thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Glenn.
The next question comes from Stephanie Caldwell from the Ventura Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you. My question, Neil, is, you know, on the Rubio bill, is there a timeline? Because what we're hearing, you know, we are predominantly very, very small business here in Ventura. And what we're hearing is people are already making the decisions to lay off either half or more of their staff. And so if we can get out there with this information and a timeline that people might be able to hold on to, we might be able to stop a little bit of the bleeding.
So I'm hesitant to promise something that may not come to fruition. I mean, I think there's going to be assistance like this, but it's hard to say what twists and turns, and obviously businesses would still have to apply, you know, through a lender to receive the loan. I will say one thing, and again, you know, I'm hesitant to suggest something that may make someone make a decision that it becomes hard to reverse in the future. But one thing that is being contemplated is to basically allow employers to hire back employees, once this becomes operational, to hire back employees that they've let go and use this program for that purpose. So that is something that again, hasn't been enacted, but we're hopeful could be done to address that very situation. But again, I would hate to be a business owner and have to make this decision and not know what's going to really happen.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Thomas O'Connor from the Capital Region Chamber.
Hi, Neil and Sarah. Thanks for doing this. Very helpful. I have a question regarding essential businesses. In New York State, are colleges and universities are not on the list? And what that has done, it's created a problem as far as what do they do with international students if they can't physically be on campus to supervise, and two, it makes it impossible for their professors to provide the online instruction without being physically on campus. Has anyone else faced that?
I can't tell you whether other folks have faced that, but I can tell you that in the submission that the chamber sent to DHS, which we drew in large part that section from the San Francisco mayor's order, there was an exception for educational institutions. As I don't recall the provision related to foreign students, but it was certainly with respect to, and K-12, for folks administering distance learning, et cetera. And there were some other provisions around that. Why don't we, I've never in my life thought I would say, we'll forward you an ordinance from San Francisco as something to take a look at. But
all right.
We're going to forward you around an ordinance from San Francisco that may be instructive.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Christina Womack from the Pasadena Chamber of Commerce.
Hi, thank you so much. One of the questions or pieces of information that was asked to share was on encouraging feedback on the types of groups that we think were missing from the essential services DHS list. Who wants to collect that information in one central place? Thank you.
This is Sarah Armstrong. You can send it to me. You can either respond to the email that was about this conference call, or my direct email is sarmstrong@uschamber.com.
Great. Thanks, Sarah.
Sure.
The next question comes from Scott Martin from the Norman Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you very much. Quick question about the stay-in-place policies. Clearly, California has taken aggressive action in this regard, and so has New York City. I was curious what the discussion is about a national stay-in-place mandate that could be coming from the White House.
At the moment, we don't anticipate one coming from the administration. They're very much encouraging states to adopt reasonable orders. I won't pretend to suggest that won't change, but at the moment, we continue to believe that this will take place at the state and the local level.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next question comes from Brad Hartkopf from the Iowa Association of Business and Industry.
Neil, thank you very much for all the work that you and your colleagues are doing at the Chamber in regards to this issue. As Leader McConnell and Leader Schumer sit down to hash out negotiations over Phase 3, can you tell us if there's any sticking points for either side as far as issues that they're looking at right now?
Yes, and I'll tell you the one that concerns me the most, which is some of the proposals out from Senator Schumer and some of his colleagues to really tie the hands of business with respect to how you operate your business as a condition of accepting assistance. And so, if you look at what's already in the bill relative to the loans for airlines and other industries, there's some restrictions about use of the money to increase compensation for executives, but some of the proposals that are out there go a lot further in that you not only have to maintain 100% of employment, maintain what you were at the levels and salaries that you previously paid people, but that there are even some proposals regarding union negotiations that you would be required to abide by as a condition of accepting funds. If depending on the industry you're in, conditions on the type of not pulling back on the services that you provide in certain communities, really things that kind of make it much more difficult. And by the way, you have to accept all these conditions up front in order to access the money to survive as a loan, and then you're bound by that in the future. And that could be terribly problematic, because as we all know, business conditions change and you may need to change your operations. And in fact, a proposal from Senator Warner, Democrat from Virginia, declares at the end that if you end up violating any of these things that you've agreed to, you're declared in default of your loan. And that is obviously a scarlet letter that no business would want. So that's going to be a huge sticking point. I think other things about, additional money that one side or the other is requesting, I suspect that can be resolved. It's really this, what mandates are they going to put on business?
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Rick Broden from Mountain Lakes Chamber of Commerce.
Yes, we are in a small rural town in northeast Alabama, a county of 52,000, a city of 15,000, and we've got small businesses. I'm talking about in the tune of 5 to 15 to 20 employees, especially restaurants, that are telling us that another week like this and they're going under. So what is their to take care of those really small places, like really small businesses, like the restaurants and other small businesses, and not, you know, that are not 500 employees or even two or 300 employees.
Yeah, so the provisions in the Senate bill would definitely be available, you know, to those businesses with five, you know, employees or so. You know, of course, these are loans, and, you know, folks are going to have to go to a lender, and they're going to have to go through that process of securing the loan. We are trying to work to find ways to make that as seamless as possible, with the understanding that, you know, if you have stay-in-place orders, it's really hard to go out and pull all the things you need to do to get a loan. You know, hopefully, the sense that these loans are available will at least be enough of a bridge for people to get through to the loan. But, you know, there's no question that there's going to be a difficulty in that. And, you know, part of the big problem is figuring out how we quickly can get money in the hands of businesses that need it. So we're trying to streamline. We're encouraging the lawmakers to streamline this as much as possible for that very purpose.
And that information will be sent out through the U.S. Chamber to all of us chambers?
Yeah, so we're going to do our best to do exactly what we did with kind of the Phase 2 bill, which is as this bill evolves, we'll keep you updated on the iterations. And then certainly once done, you know, we'll let you know kind of what's enacted. But all of this is happening in real time, so we're doing our best to both digest it and then be able to provide you all with actionable information.
Thank you very much.
Our next question comes from Cheryl Bates from Heppner Chamber of Commerce.
Hi, thanks for all this information. I actually live in a small rural town in Oregon called Heppner, and we have about 1,300 people. And our food vendors, they have to drive an hour and a half to Kennewick, Washington to get their food, groceries and stuff, and some stuff is brought in. But the question is, they've heard that they're going to start closing, you know, between state to state so that there's no travel between each of those. Have you heard that at all?
We have not heard that. And,
okay.
And in fact, that runs directly contrary to the guidance that we're trying to get out from DHS.
Well, because, yeah, that could be, I mean, we're already struggling because we have quite a few restaurants, but now that they can only serve to go and they're trying to get food and it's just really, you know, struggling for them. But then they heard that they're thinking about closing, especially for us, or between Oregon and Washington. And I just didn't think that would make sense either, because then you have to stop all the trucks and everybody. I don't know how they would maintain that. But that was a concern that I had a business owner call me today about. So
we've not
Thank you.
Seen any indication of that. I would be very surprised if that happened. And I think even in the instances where we've started to see some state or local governments go too far, we've had some success in rolling it back as soon as we're able to point out problems like this.
Okay. Thank you.
The next question comes from Jane Dredeker from the Greater Silver Spring Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you. I had a question to go back to the issue with having to keep your employees. Our restaurants and certain other businesses were ordered to close by our governor very recently, and some of them had no choice but to furlough or lay off their employees. Anything we can do to push forward this idea that if you hire them back, can they then get access to this money?
Very great point, Jane. And so what we'll, in this letter that we're preparing that we'll be asking the Federation folks to sign, we'll make sure to put that in there, because I think this is, we cannot do enough to emphasize that point. You're exactly right.
Thank you very much.
The next question comes from Kevin Brinegar from the Indiana Chamber of Commerce.
Neil, Sarah, and others, thank you so much for all you're doing. With regard to the under 500 loan sense grant, you mentioned up to $10 million limit. Is there a time limit, X number of months, that this will be in place or not? And then my second question is, came up from your earlier discussion, since Pelosi didn't negotiate with the House Republicans that I know or I've heard of, or the Senate, why is McConnell having to negotiate with Schumer?
So, answer to your first question, there is a time limit for this. I'm just looking to make sure. Period beginning March 1, 2020, ending December 31st, 2020. It is limited in the draft. In the Senate, you have to have 60 votes. And even if he wasn't negotiating with Senator Schumer, he'd still have to get – the package still has to get 218 votes in the House. So whatever happen, whatever is going to happen has to happen on a bipartisan basis.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Jane Kruger from the Rome Floyd Chamber.
Jane, are you there? Are you muted?
Yes, I wanted to ask about the Families First bill.
Uh-huh.
If you're an international company, but you have... if internationally there are over 500 employees, but just in the United States there are fewer than 500, do you still qualify?
It's a great question that I'm not sure of the answer of. We some of the definitions are pulled from the existing definitions of FMLA, and so I think... We actually looked at this last night for another member about aggregation. And so I don't want to give you a firm answer, but I tell you the things you need to look at are how your company's treated for FMLA purposes, and compare that and the rules there that might also be applied here. But there are definitely some areas where the legislation is not clear, and so I don't have a clear answer for you on that.
Okay, thank you.
The next question comes from Vicki Clark from the Cape May County Chamber of Commerce.
Yes, thank you. My question is concerning the J-1 visa international students, and it's a 4-hour businesses that are in tourism-driven economies, this program is, of course, extremely important to us. And I just wanted to put this on the radar screen. As of right now, the program was delayed until mid-May. Right now, many of the embassies have, been closed down, and visa applications are not being processed. And, summer seasons that are expecting to, kind of get ready to, we get ready to open here in the springtime and, for Memorial Day kickoff season and things like that, our businesses are really getting into a panic mode because we're not going to be able to be staffed. Just wondered if there's any insight that you can offer into any of this Department of State program.
I don't have a lot of insight I can offer. What we can do is, if you'll email Sarah, she'll hook you up with John Baselisi on our team, who has been very involved in all the changes that are going on in these immigration programs and how some of this has been affected. He may be able to give you some insight. And if nothing else, I think getting this problem on the radar, I suspect it's already on his radar, but if it's not, this is a good thing for us to be able to follow up on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Sharon Tabor from Black Mountain Swannanoa Chamber of Commerce.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Yeah, I think the question has already been answered. Mine was about the small businesses who've already laid off employees and they're struggling to survive and how this financial aid will impact them. But I believe that question's already been answered. But thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We have a question from Jim DiCola from St. Charles Chamber of Commerce.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for all the work that you're doing. I have a question on, like many in the 7A and the 100 employees or less, how, when you look at the service industry, like hairstylists, nail salons, you know, even servers that mostly work on tips, how does that come into play as to whether they're stay employed and at what kind of level of paycheck, and would that be covered under this?
You know, you mean in terms yes, this is, there's
so,
a provision in the bill.
Right.
Right.
I'm sorry?
Yep, nope. Go ahead.
All right, let's take, for example, I work at ABC Hair Salon. I'm not really an essential business, so I'm kind of put on furlough. I'm not going to get paid because, the way the pay structure is set up, you would get so much for your services. So where are those people covered?
I'm just pulling this up here.
Carol.
Hello? There is exceptions. So if you compensate tipped employees, there are exceptions in the proposal to allow the – so the loan that the employer gets, so imagine the loan that the hair salon gets, that there are – you have to follow certain rules, but if you are compensating tipped employees for the tipped wages that they lost during the next – this month and the following 2 months, that amount can be counted as wages for purposes of the loan forgiveness. Does that make sense?
I think so.
So there's a provision, obviously, you're not going to be able to tip someone that they would have gotten a $100,000 tip from someone, and so there are rules to prevent kind of abuse, but in general the goal is if the employer is making up for the employee the lost tipped wages, those lost tipped wages will be forgiven as part of the loan.
Got it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And we have time for one last question. It comes from Karen Grott from the Lebanon Valley Chamber.
Thank you. I have a very similar question to the last one in an employer conversation that we had today that we opened up online. We had questions from those who don't have employees. They're small businesses and they're family run, or they are sole proprietors and they're trying to figure out how they're going to cover their losses for not working and not being able to work for many weeks. Is there anything at all that we can provide to them as resources?
When we get out the and we're currently in the process of working out the summary of this bill, we'll be sure to identify how the process works for the self-employed. Also for the self-employed, this disaster unemployment insurance program that I talked about earlier in the call, that could end up being pretty critical. And so, well, obviously not a full replacement of wages, at least for individuals who are independent contractors or self-employed who are seeing no income, that may be a benefit that they want to avail themselves of. And so the team is currently putting together the process. So we'll provide both background on that, but importantly, because this is a program that involves state and federal interaction, it's going to be important that your state governments take action to provide access to the program to individuals in your state.
Thank you. And now I would like to turn the call back to our presenters for any closing remarks.
Well, thank you very much. And again, thanks to Neil and Michelle for joining today. I know that their feedback has been very helpful, hopefully, with these questions that everybody's asked. I know there's a lot of confusion in some of these things, so we will continue to provide updates to you all as we get them. We'll be sending the bill summary, as Neil mentioned. We'll be getting you additional material. So I know this is important for us to get that to you, and we'll do that in a timely fashion. And don't hesitate to reach out to any of us by email if you have any questions. We're here to help and want to be a resource to you as we move through the next days, weeks, and months. So thanks for joining us. We'll do another call like this next Friday. We'll send an update to you all, but in the meantime, check your emails for additional updates via email and other sources that we'll be sending you. Okay? Thanks, and have a great day. We'll talk soon.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. We thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.